Another notable benefit of the denial of this kind of joy is that much denial begets deep tranquility of soul, a void of distractions and recollections to the senses, especially to the eyes. Undesirous of this joy, a person does not want to look at or occupy the other senses with these things, that he may avoid being attracted or ensnared by them and wasting time or thought. He bears resemblance to the prudent serpent that stops its ears so as not to hear the charmers, lest they make some impression upon it. Psalm 57. By guarding the senses, the gates of the soul, one decidedly safeguards and brings increase to one's peace and purity of soul. There is another benefit of no less importance for those who are already advanced in the mortification of this kind of joy, and it is that the obscene objects and ideas do not cause in them the impression and impurity that they do in those who still become content with some of this joy. Consequently, from the denial and mortification of this joy, spiritual purity of soul and body, of spirit and sense arises, and the individual gradually acquires angelic likeness to God, and his soul and body become a worthy temple of the Holy Spirit. This could not be so if his heart rejoiced in natural goods and graces. It is not necessary that there be consent to some obscene thing or a remembrance of it in order to soil the purity of soul, since this kind of joy, coupled with knowledge of the natural good, is sufficient to cause impurity of spirit and sense. The wise man declares that the Holy Spirit will withdraw from the thoughts that are without understanding, that is, without the superior reason ordered to God. Wisdom 1:5. Another general benefit coming to the soul, besides freedom from the above-mentioned evils, is freedom from countless vanities and other kinds of spiritual and temporal harm, especially from being held in disesteem, which is the lot of those who boast about natural endowments and rejoice in them, whether they are their own or another's. Accordingly, those who pay no attention to such things, but are interested in what is pleasing to God, are considered and esteemed to be discreet and wise, and indeed they are. The last benefit follows upon these, that is, liberty of spirit, by which the soul easily conquers temptations, passes through trials, and grows prosperously in virtue. This is an excellent good and very necessary in serving God. Chapter 24 of Book 3. Our next subject is joy in the sensory goods, the third kind in which the will can rejoice. It should be known that by sensory goods we mean all the goods apprehensible to the senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, and to the interior faculty of discursive imagination. They are goods pertinent to the exterior and interior senses. To darken and purge the will of joy in these sensory goods and lead through them to God, we must presuppose a truth. It is, as we have often said, that the senses of the lower part of man's nature, with which we are dealing neither are nor can be capable of the knowledge or comprehension of God as he is in himself. The eye cannot see him or anything like him, nor the hearing perceive his voice or any sound resembling it, nor can the sense of smell apprehend a fragrance so sweet, nor the sense of taste relish so sublime and delightful a savor, nor can the sense of touch experience a feeling so delicate and ravishing, nor anything similar. Neither is God's form or any figure representing it apprehensible to thought or imagination. Isaiah thus affirms, "Eye has not seen him, nor our ear heard him, nor has it entered into the heart of man." Isaiah 64. It is noteworthy that the senses can receive satisfaction and delight either from the Spirit through some communication received interiorly from God, or from exterior things apprehended by them. And as was said, the sensory part of man can have knowledge of God through neither the senses nor the Spirit. Being incapable of such an attainment, it receives the spiritual insensible in only a sensual way. As a result, it would be at least vanity for the will to pause to rejoice in the gratification caused by any of these apprehensions. And the strength of the will would be hindered from employing all its joy in God alone. One cannot concentrate one's joy entirely on God save through the purgation and darkness of joy in this kind of good, as well as in the others. I purposely said that it would be vanity for the will to pause to rejoice in any of these apprehensions, for when the will, in becoming aware of the satisfaction afforded by the object of sight, hearing, or touch, does not stop with this joy, but immediately elevates itself to God, rejoicing in him who motivates and gives strength to its joy, it is doing something very good. The will, then, does not have to avoid such experiences when they produce this devotion in prayer, but it can profit by them, and even ought to, for the sake of so holy an exercise. For there are souls who are greatly moved toward God by sensible objects. Yet one should be careful in this matter and take into consideration its effects. Frequently, spiritual persons use this refreshment of the senses under the pretext of prayer and devotion to God. They so perform these exercises that we could call what they do recreation rather than prayer, and pleasing self rather than God. Though the intention of these persons is directed to God, the effect they receive is recreation of the senses, from which they obtain weakness and imperfection more than the quickening of their will and its surrender to God. I should like to offer a norm for discerning when this gratification of the senses is beneficial and when not. Whenever a person, upon hearing music or other things, seeing agreeable objects, smelling sweet fragrance, or feeling the delight of certain tastes and delicate touches, immediately at the first movement, directs his thought and the affection of his will to God, receiving more satisfaction in the thought of God than in the sensible object that caused it, and finds no gratification in the senses save for this motive. It is a sign that he is profiting by the senses, and that the sensory part is a help to the spirit. The senses can then be used because the sensual objects serve the purpose for which God created them, that he be more known and loved through them. It should be understood here that he in whom these sensible objects cause this purely spiritual effect does not on that account have an appetite for them, nor does he hardly care for them at all, even though they do provide great satisfaction when presented to him. For as I mentioned, they cause him pleasure in God. Thus he is not solicitous about these sensible goods, and when, as I say, they are offered to him, his will immediately leaves them aside, passing on to God. The reason this person pays no attention to these sensible motives, even though they help him go to God, is that his spirit, which has this readiness to go to God in and through all things, is so provided for, nourished and satisfied by God's Spirit, that it is unwanting and undesirous of anything else. And if it is desirous of something in order to turn to God, it immediately passes beyond this object, forgetting and paying no attention to it. Yet anyone who does not feel this freedom of spirit in these sensible objects and gratifications, but finds that his will pauses in and feeds upon them, suffers harm from them, and ought to turn from their use. Though according to reason, he may want help from them in order to go to God, nonetheless, they assuredly prove more hindrance than a help, and a harm rather than a benefit, since the appetite finds gratification in them according to the senses, and the effect is always conformed to the pleasure. When he sees that the appetite for these recreations reigns within himself, he should mortify it, because the stronger his appetite, the weaker and more imperfect he is. The spiritual person, then, in whatever sensory gratification comes his way, intentionally or by chance, ought to benefit from it only for the sake of going to God, by raising his joy of soul to him, that this joy may be useful, profitable, and perfect. He should note that every joy unaccompanied by this negation and annihilation of all other joys, even when they concern something apparently very elevated, is vain and profitless and a hindrance to union of the will with God. Chapter 25 of Book 3. In the first place, all the kinds of harm born of other types of joy spring from this joy in sensory goods, if it is not darkened and quelled through direction to God. These kinds of harm are, for example, obscurity of reason, lukewarmness, spiritual tedium. But in particular, there are many types, spiritual and corporal or sensual, which can be directly incurred through this joy. First, through failure to deny for God joy in visible objects, the following evils result directly: vanity of spirit, mental distraction, inordinate covetousness, indecency, interior and exterior discomposure, impurity in thought, and envy. Joy in hearing useless things gives direct rise to distraction of the imagination, gossiping, envy, uncertain judgments, and wandering thoughts, followed by many other pernicious kinds of harm. Joy in sweet fragrance foments disgust for the poor, which is contrary to Christ's doctrine, aversion for servants, unsubmissiveness of heart in humble things, and spiritual irresponsiveness, at least in the measure of the appetite. Joy in the delights of food directly engenders gluttony and drunkenness, anger, discord, and lack of charity toward one's neighbor and the poor, as in the case of Lazarus and the rich man who ate sumptuously each day. Luke chapter 16, 19-21. Accordingly, there arise bodily disorders, infirmities, and impure movements due to increasing incentives of lust. A decided spiritual torpor is directly engendered, and the desire for spiritual things is so spoiled that one finds no satisfaction in them and is unable to discuss or take part in them. Distraction of the other senses and of the heart and discontent over many things are also born of this joy. Enjoyment in the touch of soft objects foments more numerous and more pernicious kinds of harm, and by it the senses more quickly pervert the spirit and extinguish its strength and vigor. The consequence is the indomitable vice of effeminacy, or incentives toward it in proportion to this kind of joy. This joy foments lust. It makes the spirit unmanly and timid, and the senses flattering, honey-mouthed, disposed toward sin and the causing of harm. It pours vain gladness and mirth into the heart, engenders license of the tongue and freedom of the eyes, and brings on ravishment and stupefaction of the other senses according to the intensity of the appetite. It confounds the judgment, nurturing it on spiritual incipience and stupidity. And by this darkness of soul and weakness of heart, it makes one fear where there is no reason for fear. This joy sometimes begets the spirit of confusion and unresponsiveness of conscience and spirit, since it seriously debilitates reason and reduces it to such a state that one knows not how either to take counsel or to give it, and it leaves the soul incapable of moral and spiritual blessings, as useless as a broken jar. All these evils are caused by this kind of joy, according to the intensity of the joy, and also according to the disposition, the weakness, or the inconstancy of the individual. For some temperaments receive more detriment from one small occasion than others do from many. Finally, from this kind of rejoicing in touch, one can fall into so much evil and harm, as we pointed out, from natural goods, that since it is discussed there, I shall not refer to it here. Neither shall I speak of many other kinds of harm caused. As such, the diminution of spiritual exercises and corporeal penances, and lukewarmness and lack of devotion in the use of the sacraments of penance and the Eucharist. Chapter 26 of Book 3. The benefits acquired from the negation of this joy are admirable. Some are spiritual and others temporal. First, by withdrawing his joy from sensible things, a man is restored from the distraction into which he had fallen through excessive use of his senses. He becomes recollected in God and conserves the spirit and virtues he has acquired. These virtues increase and the soul advances. The second spiritual benefit a person procures from not desiring joy in sensible things is excellent. We can truthfully say that from sensual he becomes spiritual, and from animal, rational, and even that from what is of a man in him, he advances to the angelic, and from earthly and human he becomes heavenly and divine. As the man who looks for gratification and enjoyment in sensible objects deserves no other title than these we mentioned, sensual, animal, earthly, so when he elevates his joy above these sensible goods, he deserves all those other titles, spiritual, heavenly, angelic. This is obviously true, for since the exercise of the senses and the strength and sensuality on contrary, as the Apostle says, to spiritual exercises and vigor, Galatians chapter 5, verse 17, it follows that upon the enervation of one of these forces, the other contrary one, unaugmentable due to this impediment, must grow and increase. Thus, in the perfecting of the spirit, the superior portion of the soul, which refers to God and communicates with him, a person merits all these attributes, since he is perfected in the spiritual and the heavenly goods and the gifts of God.